You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Few of us will forget the image of a small, frail 12-year-old boy lying in the hospital in Iraq asking, "Can you give me back my arms?" Today, according to the London Dispatch, a successful first skin graft operation was performed on Ali Ismail Abbas, the 12-year-old Iraqi boy who lost both arms and was orphaned in a U.S. missile strike on his home. Dr. April Hurley of Santa Rosa, California, spent several weeks in Iraq with the humanitarian group Voices in the Wilderness, visiting hospitals, and was in the hospital when Ali arrived and saw him before his arms were amputated. Peace Watch spoke to her today about her visit with Ali and the extent of his injuries. Hurley also discussed her adventures of traveling across the U.S. by train for 2 days upon her return to readjust to life in the U.S. She was in Baghdad during the entire U.S. bombing campaign.
I was conflicted coming home with so much anger about what we've done in Baghdad, what we've done in Iraq, and even the news in Amman, Jordan wasn't good when I went to U.N. press briefings. Very disheartening. And I'm somebody who previously had no connection to Iraq. I can't imagine what it's like to be an Iraqi person with living in the States, with family in Iraq, or to be an American with relationships with Iraq families and see what they are going through, what they've been through, what we've done to them. I feel conflicted coming back to the States, especially with the desperation that we had as activists trying to stop this steamrolling and failing to do so, even with the numbers that were coming out against the war, even the global feeling against the war. So coming back to the United States and seeing some of the business as usual, complacency, consumerism, all that in your face is hard. Regardless of the ignorance, regardless of the insular feeling that Americans have, regardless of their, regardless of all that, how beautiful we are, how beautiful our country is, our land is.
What kind of reaction did people have to the story that you were telling them? How much of your story did you share with people?
Different people, I'd share different parts of the story, and towards the end of the trip, it just kind of got difficult for me to rehash it again. But the response generally was very good. A lot of ignorance, a lot of people misled by the media, a lot of people with kind of a blind nationalism. And
how did you respond to that?
Well, I tried to teach while I was talking, mm-hmm. and teach with the experience I had, but also the news that came out internationally.
Can you give us an example, perhaps just one example of an exchange that you had, perhaps the most memorable?
Well, the one that was currently upsetting me was the delay of the breaking the news of the boy with the army amputations, Ali Ismail. That was upsetting to me, and I had to tell people. Ali had his loss of his family, the terrible bombing that occurred on the 30th of March. The story didn't break in the American and the British press, though it did break in the international press. It didn't break in the American or British press until after the bombing was over. That was 11 days later. So there was 11 days of bombing, mm-hmm. without the Americans seeing some of the casualties that we had tried to spread pictures of through our connections with journalists, our connections with the American media. And even by sending people who were deported with CD-ROMs and floppies with the story. Mm-hmm.
So, and what was it that you... We know that Ali Ismail lost both his arms through a bombing. Was there more to the story that you were trying to get out?
Well, mostly that the terrible experience that he's living with how delayed the story was in breaking was mainly, I think, editing by corporate media in the United States, because it took so long for that story to get out, whereas every other story that got out was immediate. Mm-hmm. The fall of Saddam statue, the the taking down of the statue, the bombing of the Palestine Hotel, things that were immediate, we have immediate news relay, mm-hmm. got out. This was delayed. All the casualty pictures were delayed. People saw this as a sterile precision bombing campaign. Sterile meaning bloodless, no injuries, no carnage. And in fact, it was the opposite. It was the opposite, because a lot of these targets were in civilian neighborhoods. So I was able to share some of those thoughts, mm-hmm. and some of my concern about what Americans knew, what they were shown, and what actually was happening in Iraq. And even to this day, I listen to the news and I hear the bias. You know, my heart's breaking, because mm-hmm. I know the stories that are not being told.
The mainstream corporate media in this country sort of justified their not showing some of the, or explained why they didn't show some of the pictures of the civilian casualties of war, in one instance saying that, well, we have to determine whether these pictures are tasteful or not to show to the audience. You know a little bit more about Ali Ismail's case than most of us. What was the extent of his injuries?
Oh, he had incredible burns, third-degree burns on his torso. Most of his chest and abdomen were third-degree burns. That whole area of skin has to be removed and replaced with other skin, and he's facing many episodes of sepsis, difficulty controlling infection with antibiotics, difficult controlling infection in a hospital burn unit anywhere, even in the United States, and he's got amputation sites that are not safe. In other words, his left arm has been amputated so high, I'm sure they took the whole bone, and I'm sure that his shoulder is just closed over with skin and muscle, but there wasn't a whole lot of tissue to do that, and I'm just afraid that those sites are going to break down. His right arm has a length of bone that was retained, I'm sure, and covered with skin and muscle, but he's going to grow as a boy. He's only 12. And as he grows, that bone will have to be cut back as that bone grows and attempts to extend and threaten the closure of that skin and muscles. So he's looking forward to infection, grafting, terrible pain as his dressings are removed and replaced, terrible surgeries to come, and rehabilitation. Not to mention what emotional trauma he's going to be dealing with, having all his family killed, including his extended family.
Dr. April Hurley of the humanitarian group Voices in the Wilderness. Ali underwent a 3.5-hour operation to 75% of the burns on his body, according to Kuwaiti Health Ministry spokesperson Ahmed Al-Shati. He was diagnosed with burns to more than 20% of his body on his arrival at the Burns Center in Kuwait on April 16th. As the war on Iraq winds down, North Korea and Syria are moving into the spotlight as possible future targets of U.S. military intervention. Scott C. Davis traveled through Syria during the first 10 days of the Iraq War and asked ordinary Syrians to share their thoughts on the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. His most recent book is titled The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria.
Friday, March 21st. Friday is a day of meditation and prayer for Muslims. In consideration of Islamic sensitivities, the United States waited until 9 p.m. to launch its eight-hour assault. At the moment bombs began to fall on Baghdad, I was in Damascus, walking the narrow, crooked streets of the old city. I came to a trendy night spot, the Oxygen Bar. Inside, I heard pulsating disco music, but saw no customers. It's not late enough, I thought. Damascus is a late city. Or maybe it's the war. Outside the bar, I saw three young men approaching. I didn't really want company. I'm an American, you see, and on this night, 3,000 American cruise missiles were targeted on Baghdad. Each one of them was a reason that these men would hate me. The tallest of the three looked at me and smiled. Pretty soon we were talking. We're here in the old city of Damascus, standing outside the really sexy Oxygen bar.
Yeah.
And I am speaking with three gentlemen from East Asia. They say that they are Sherkas or Circassians, famous noble warriors that they say were born on the back of a horse.
Thanks a lot. Thanks
in ancient days. Now tell me, what's your name?
My name is Nart. It's a famous Circassian name. I'm from Circassia, but yeah, I'm living here in Syria. I'm studying here in Syria. So, you know, I'm 20 years old. I'm going to study directing and cinema.
Well, yesterday, the American forces launched cruise missiles against Baghdad, against targets of opportunity, which I think means they were trying to kill Saddam Hussein. Do you have any comment?
You know, it's war. All of us hate war.
Well, what do you think the mood is in Damascus among the Arabs, both Muslim and Christian, toward the war that's going on right now?
Okay, Damascus, honestly, Damascus is empty now. Streets, as you say now, it's empty. All the people are staying home, watching TV. What's the important thing? How many days the war will last up? So it's kind of anxious people here. They are all anxious about the situation. I think Syrian people hate war. They are very innocent. And you can see it from these streets that you have visited in Damascus. They are innocent. They are kind people. I don't believe that anyone here in Damascus wanted the war or look at the war with a good eye. All hate war. All hate war.
The Americans think that by attacking Iraq and kicking out Saddam Hussein, that they will be having a better chance to prevent Islamic terrorism, even though they haven't proved that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with Islamic terrorism.
Yeah.
They think just in the future they would be better positioned to do so.
You know, my idea is that Islam is not a terrorist. We're gonna have an idea that Islam loves people. Iraqi people are so innocent. American innocent too. We have seen what have been in 11 September in America. It's so terrorist. So terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
So we hate terrorists. All of hate terrorists. Yeah.
All of you do what?
Yeah. Hate terrorism.
Nart Suleiman and his two companions said goodbye and walked off. I went the other direction as the call to prayer echoed through the narrow streets. I was left with a puzzle. These three students weren't mature adults. They weren't wealthy and had limited experience of the world. Yet they could distinguish between the American government and the American people. How many Americans, I wondered, would be equally gracious were the situation reversed? My country was dropping bombs on Baghdad as Nart and I spoke. Nart did not like the bombs or the war. Even so, he had charity and goodwill toward Americans.
That was Scott C. Davis, author of The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria. Even as Bush announced today that military force in Iraq is officially ending, peace activists across the country are continuing to mobilize against the occupation of Iraq. The End of the War Grassroots Coalition is gearing up for a four-day conference, May 1st through May 4th, here in the nation's capital. The conference will address the U.S. invasion of Iraq and implications and strategies for the peace movement. Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch producer for Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, spoke with Mike Zmalek, the outreach coordinator of this 300-member organization, about the network's activities and the relevance of this annual conference to the peace movement in this country.
How did the end of war come about as a coalition?
In response to what we were seeing coming out of UNICEF and World Health Organizations, the kind of statistics on infant mortality rates rising and just the deprivation that was so intense under sanctions, so that by the mid to late 90s, there was a growing movement in this country of people from faith-based organizations, student organizations, peace centers, trying to do something to address this calamity. In 1999, there was a conference in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it was a large conference. About 300 scholars and students came together. And there was discussion of forming a network at that point, a network of people who came together out of compassion and concern for the people of Iraq. A year and a half later in Denver, 2001 February, we had another conference and formed the National Network to End the War Against Iraq.
What are some of the activities that the various organizations and the network has engaged in the last few years?
We started off by having nationally coordinated days of action locally. So in April 2001, we had almost 30 cities engaged in simultaneous actions, trying to raise education, public awareness kinds of activities locally. In San Francisco, Jeffrey Grubler came up with the idea of bottling sludge and taking it to your politicians. He had these actually manufactured labels you would put on a water bottle. This would actually look like it came from a factory, and it had a whole write-up on the situation of Iraq's contaminated drinking water. And people were taking this to their senators and their congressmen and saying, have some of Iraq's drinking water. This is what the people of Iraq have to drink. So a very direct approach. Other types of actions we did a campaign around depleted uranium, which is one of our focuses to raise awareness about the U.S.'s use of radiological weapons, which continue, and its effect on the health of the Iraqis and its effect on U.S. troops, and the lack of research, the need for good research to find out what is the link between, say, Gulf War syndrome and the use of these radiological weapons.
What's the reaction to your various actions within the different cities?
Overall, good. I mean, depleted uranium is one of those issues where once people get it, they get it, and they realize that this is a nightmare scenario, and that it's some evil genius in the Pentagon came up with this idea of using the tailings from uranium mining and turning it into weapons. It has all kinds of advantages from a military strategic point of view, but the health consequences are devastating, and the government, frankly, just doesn't seem to have any interest in finding out what those consequences are. And I think it's the same with the sanctions. When people saw the statistics and they got the stories and they saw the films, then, minds and hearts were changed. And so I think the response was generally very positive, and we've seen all of our member groups grow.
Then, since the recent invasion of Iraq by the U.S. and U.K. troops, and now the occupation, what's going on with the network?
Well, we need to have a conference to talk about where we're going to take it from now. Since last fall, there's been a proliferation of groups working on Iraq when it really became clear that George Bush was serious about going through with this invasion. We've all seen this amazing movement that's taken place and the growth of the peace movement. And, we've felt like a smaller player in the larger scheme of things because we are a network of community-based organizations. We haven't been on center stage in the national spotlight, but we've gotten far more media attention and we've been far busier than we thought. People just continued to subscribe on our website and get plugged in. So what we really need to do now is refocus and figure out what to do with this network and how we're going to address the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Iraq and all of the implications of what this invasion means for the people of Iraq and also for Americans.
So what are some of your planned activities during these 4 days conference?
We're going to have 2 days of educating ourselves about what's actually going on in Iraq and trying to put it in some perspective, and then 2 days of strategic planning to decide how do we respond to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The conference will be kicked off with high school and college student teaching, 7:30 p.m. in Francis Scott Key Hall at the University of Maryland. The format will be to have a speaker and then open it up fairly quickly for questions and to hear from students what their questions are about the situation in Iraq and the war. I think everybody has a lot of questions, but it'll be very interesting to see what students are asking right now. And our guest speaker is Nathaniel Hurd. He's a consultant on UN Iraq policy. And we're waiting to hear from the office of Dennis Kucinich, representative from Ohio, presidential candidate in 2004 with the Democrats. Then on Friday, all day long, we have seminars and workshops, starting in the workshops with a workshop on the effects of war on women. The idea of the educational component was for us to hear from some of the experts who are following what's going on very closely. People are so busy doing activism that a lot of time we don't have time to keep up with the news or go even more in depth. So this is a chance to go more in depth and to get an idea of what the reality is. That can be a background for our discussion on the weekend, as we then consider what really needs to be done. obviously, there's an ongoing humanitarian crisis in Iraq. Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? Will there, you know, what are the prospects for ongoing violence within Iraq? And in the afternoon, we have a panel which will take a kind of a regional survey of Syria, Iran, Afghanistan, perhaps, and we'll try to put Iraq in the perspective of what's going on in the Middle East in general.
And I see some notes about the Patriot Act and the initiative of a referendum process. What's that?
Well, we've just heard about Arcata, California, passing a resolution to halt the effect of the Patriot Act and say that it has no jurisdiction in their community. And we have a speaker coming, Jessica Markham, who's going to speak about this activity and the process of doing local resolutions and referendums, as we saw with the Cities for Peace campaign, and how effective that can be, and give us some ideas about how to carry that kind of work forward.
And how can people learn more about the conference?
Our website, www.endthewar.org. The conference page, www.endthewar.org/conference.htm.
The fourth annual Conference to End the War Network will take place Thursday, May 1st to Sunday, May 4th at the University of Maryland in the Washington, D.C. area. Thanks to Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch producer from WPFW Pacifica Station in Washington, for that segment. Finally, the corporate media has come under criticism continually since the Bush administration began beating the drums of war against Iraq. The criticism continues because of what some would call the complicity of the media in practicing the art of omission. Pacifica listener Michael Woodson was troubled by a recent article he read in the New York Times, and he offers this reflection.
From the gas shortage of the 1970s, the Iran gate of the 80s, and the sex and corporate scandals of the 90s, I used to think the chaos in news reporting resulted from the complexity of world affairs. But now that I am a consummate mainstream news skeptic, I realize that the confusion stems from an inadequate press who runs lackey errands for the crime bosses. In fact, no reader can sort out important political issues because the news, even as it dismisses history, won't report today's events with a single standard. I teach English rhetoric, and my message to my students is this: trust nothing in the mainstream news. From Newsweek to the National Enquirer, they are all unreliable. A case in point comes from a headline in the early edition of the New York Times for Sunday, April 27, 2003. Leading Iraqi scientist says he lied to UN inspectors, by Judith Miller. Paragraph 1 reports that the Iraqi scientist Nisar Hindawi said that stories he and other scientists told the United Nations about the extent of Iraq's effort to produce weapons of mass destruction, quote, were all lies. The headline writer wanted to convey the idea that Hussein forced all his scientists to lie. I read the article for specifics. When did they lie? What lies did they tell? But the specifics hardly existed. They were buried, if they existed at all. Paragraph 2 reports that these scientists are now free to talk about the Iraqi weapons program. This little factoid that they are now, quote, free to talk, comes straight from Orwell's Ministry of Truth. And writing to the end of the same single-sentence paragraph is in an impossibly unclear pronoun clause of 46 words. It says Iraq had indeed lately acknowledged producing chemical weapons, which is counterintuitive of the headline. In paragraph 3 through 5, Hindawi states that Hussein had given orders to destroy the chemical weapons, that such weapons were not deadly, and that Iraq never had the worst kind of anthrax. All of this, too, is information explicitly counterintuitive to the headline. So I ask, why aren't these running headlines? Iraq has yet to fire a single chemical weapon at U.S. troops. Or, scientists say Iraq's weapons pose no threat. Compounding chaos with madness, paragraphs 6 and 7 say that current U.N. inspectors doubt Hindawi's assertion that Iraq never had the capacity to make the extremely lethal dried anthrax. These UN authorities discredited Hindawi for his limited knowledge. They want dry anthrax in Iraq, and they will have it. Throw down weapons, anyone? Then there it is in paragraph 16. We see the lie referenced by the headline. In 1994, Hindawi had lied to the UN by stating that he was in charge of a single-cell protein facility. Now, Hindawi told this lie in 1994, far predating the 2002-3 UN inspections, and a lie entirely irrelevant to the Bush 2 Gulf invasion. Following that is information that questions his credibility as a witness. He had gotten crosswise with the Iraqi government because he wanted a higher salary. He had also given sensitive scientific information to Libya in an act of treason to Iraq. Therefore, the headline is predicated on the word of a disgruntled employee, a failed traitor and defector, and a biological weapons engineer. Now, thinking I missed something, I turned to my local newspaper because it runs Times articles. And indeed, the same article did run in the Houston Chronicle under the headline, "Iraqi Scientist Gives Details of Country's Biological Program." Worse than the Times, the Chronicle gave a much abbreviated, chopped up, and incoherent version of Miller's story. Even though the first paragraph left in the reference to Iraqi lies, the Chronicle cut out the paragraph of Hindawi's lie. The information, the, quote, details promised in the headline is scant and predates 1989. However, the Chronicle's article was updated with late Times information that should have been headlines. The Bush administration is tripling its efforts to find scientists and evidence for weapons of mass destruction, rather than the weapons themselves. We might note the change in Bush administration policy delivered in an afterthought. Quote, rather than the weapons themselves. The U.S. government won't need throw-down weapons after all. Hence, the deeper plot runs this way. The message to Iraqi scientists is to come over to the U.S. government now and say what you dare. The U.S. government has tripled the force of inspectors to find you out. Only give evidence, no weapons themselves needed. Some of my newspaper reading adult life has been spent frustrated by the confusions and deceptions practiced by the corporate press, whose writers would do their profession honor to write impartially and quit propagandizing. I always restrain from the temptation to extreme politics, but headline after headline of the kind carried by the Times and the Chronicle have forced me to conclude that nothing in the press is trustworthy.
Michael Woodson listens to Peace Watch on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey, and our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adil Hamid of KPFA, Keith Shaljian, Benta Berklin, and T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.